welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
I'm speaking with Paulina Borsuk. She's the author of an upcoming book, Cyber Selfish, a critique of techno-libertarianism in American culture.
Hi.
I was very fascinated with the early writings that I had read from you when you were writing for Wired and several other publications, and I was very delighted to hear. I think you'd be amused to find out how I heard about your book.
Yes, I was.
There was a summary that was published, I guess, in New York Times or Wall Street Journal someplace that was then sent out on email on the Extropians high-tech list, which I'm on. And they said, oh, look at this. You know, this comes on the heels of the Bill Joy piece. You know, is the world coming to an end? All these people.
I guess maybe the world as they want it to be is coming to an end.
Exactly.
I don't know.
All these
well,
people.
Yeah, it's funny because years ago I did on Wired what was called a brain tennis, which is kind of like a point counterpoint,
that's
you know,
right.
Jane Ignorant Slut thing
with
Max
Crown
Moore
Prince, yeah.
Of the who's you know whatever his title is, Grand High Poobah at the Extropian Institute,
right.
And it was very amusing. so they definitely know who I am.
Yeah. Well, the book sounds fascinating, and we want to get into some of the topics here.
Yeah.
The reason d'etre of this show is actually the left political critique of this field, and I'm pretty optimistic about most of this stuff, but it's very clear that, as you point out, that libertarianism is the dominant culture in the cyber world and cyber culture. Now, do you live out in the Bay Area?
Yeah, I'm actually in Santa Cruz, which is sort of the greater Bay Area. You know, it's about 75 miles south of San Francisco, and increasingly becoming a bedroom city for Silicon Valley, bedroom community for Silicon Valley.
So are there particular experiences that led you to write this book?
Gosh.
Coffee table.
Too numerous to count. Well, what I always say is, I grew up in Pasadena, which is sort of Caltech JPL, and that was sort of an earlier sort of technology culture, and and these are the parents of the kids I grew up with, and they had certain attitudes towards government and, in the sense of community and blah, 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 without getting into that. And so when I stumbled into Silicon Valley in the early 80s, I thought, wow, these are like the guys I know growing up. Oh, friendly, happy nerds. But then as I got to know them, though, as people, they seemed a lot like the parents of my friends when I was growing up. Their attitude, mindset, and philosophy was really, really different. And I couldn't figure out why, because while I'm an old hippie and know all the bad things the government can do, no sector of society has benefited more and suffered less from the government than high tech. And so as soon as I don't understand something, I become really fascinated by it. And so I've kind of been observing this, really since the 80s. And then when I stumbled into writing for Wired a lot in the early 90s, that was such a hotbed of libertarianism that I was just kind of, whoa, what is this? So it was, I hate to say it, it was just sort of atmospheric in the air that I breathe. There wasn't any single precipitating incident.
Hmm. Now, one of the things that you write about in your book is the influence of biological metaphors. Is this critique that you're waging about neo-Darwinism in particular?
Or? Well, it's kind of subtle because, there's this kind of strange borrowing from biology. You hear all the high tech, small fleet mammals and lumbering dinosaur companies and low-hanging fruit and ecological niches and, but most people in high tech would not say that they're social Darwinists because there's nothing eugenic about it. But the thing is, a lot of them don't really understand biology at all. And what they often don't understand is like a healthy ecosystem tends to be somewhat stable. And that shelter often is where, shelter in ecosystems is often where you get all kinds of interesting species. And, yet, shelter in the economic sense, is not something which, in other words, protection from monopolies and not subjecting everything to market discipline is something that they're really opposed to. So there's this weird disconnect between how biology really works and how they like to borrow biological thinking. But it is all over high tech. It's all over the Bay Area. And it's kind of strange. But you can't make them like 19th century social Darwinists, even though unconsciously that's the consequence of what they're saying, because they're saying the meritocracy works and it's survival of the fittest, but they wouldn't say it's, because, well, they might say you're born genetically defective, but it doesn't have anything to do with race, for example.
Mm-hmm. Now, the grand editor of Wired, Kevin Kelly.
Well, he was the executive editor. He was the editor-in-chief.
He's editor-in-chief. He's written a book about the influence of biology as both a metaphor and...
Right. He's written a lot on that, actually.
An analytical framework.
Right.
He's pretty influential in this whole field.
Well, he has been. Remember, he left Wired a couple of years ago, and I don't even know... And the new Wired is another business board magazine like Business 2.0 or Fast Company. So we have to talk... This is current history we're talking about. And, you know, and he has been very interested in those ideas of borrowing from biology and, you know, chaos and complexity theory and, how birds flock can be a model for all economic behavior. I mean, he's been very besotted with this and a lot of people like what he does.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people associate the libertarianism of this crypto subculture, this cyber subculture,
yeah,
with hackers and hacking. And, of course, now we had the love bug virus this week.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you saw the reporting from Philippines, but that this computer science student was a part of what they refer to in the newspaper as a gang, sounded more like a business to me, mm-hmm, of guys who were writing term papers for other computer science students and selling them to them. And apparently the virus came out of their circle, and when they asked him why he had written his senior thesis to steal passwords, he said that because the internet was too expensive and he thought it was the common property of all mankind and that it should be free, access to the internet should be free. So he was going to have this program steal passwords and make the internet generally accessible. So kind of a weird...
it's a weird kind of permutation of a lot of ideas that are floating around in that culture. And what people forget forget when they want to, is that the old ARPANET, you know, predecessor of the internet, was a really wonderful communitarian exercise by a lot of academics who worked there for, you know, 15 years, you know, unsung, no financial reward, weren't thinking about that at all. And they had a lot of, you know, information communitarian values. But that's percolated out into the world in all kinds of strange ways. Now, I don't have this phobia about hackers that seems to capture the popular imagination. I mean, there is this, you know, there has been this historical culture of a sort of, you know, tweaking authority and sort of doing Kilroy was here that hackers often do. But, you know, I'm sorry, that at worst, that's malicious mischief to me. And there's sort of a long history of doing that in high tech. And, on the list of possible crimes against humanity, it rates pretty low in terms of, what I think about. But this, you know, the kids in the Philippines, I mean, this whole thing of the net was formed on, you know, and kind of free access to information, a whole bunch of stuff. And meanwhile, it's been really corporatized. And there's a lot of tension. I mean, I don't even want to get into the intellectual property wars. There's a lot of tension between what should be free and who should pay for it. And, and that is an infinitely complicated topic to get into. But this notion of it should be free for everybody and information should be free is great, except there's always a thing, well, somebody has to pay for it, whether it's the power grid or the routers or keeping the databases updated or how do you compensate artists for what they do. That's a whole complicated thing, but it's an adolescent mindset to think, well, it should all be free.
Right.
I mean, I'm totally anti-censorship, but I'm saying it's just more complicated than people realize.
Right. The reaction to Metallica's call for a crackdown on the sharing of MP3 files I thought was particularly funny. It's like, why wouldn't musicians be angry that their music was being stolen?
Right. And, you know, and teenagers and college kids, they're up against the man, and, you know, they're going after the big bad record companies, who I admit are really, really terrible, but they're forgetting that the person getting messed over are the artist, and somehow that gets lost in the equation.
Mm-hmm. Now, we mentioned Wired. Bill Joy has written recently, the mm-hmm, chief scientist and co-founder of Sun Microsystems. He's recently written a very dark meditation on the responsibility of scientists and computer people to put a halt to and call for basically an international moratorium on moves towards nanotechnology. And he includes in that also genetic engineering and mm-hmm, robotics. Do you think that there is a changing mood out there, that the combined issues of Microsoft, of hacking, the MP3 debates, the potential threats that these different technologies pose are beginning to cause a maturation in the politics of cyberculture?
Well, I'd like that to be true. And I think there's some sense that And I think it was like a Ponte famous, you know, he's at the Media Lab and he used to be a columnist for Wired and an early investor in Wired, and he had this famous thing about how it's bits, not atoms, and there's this general notion that floats around high tech of what I call virtuality. I have a whole rant when I say virtuality is bosh, but basically we are disconnected from the surly bonds of Earth and, you know, don't fit in, don't have to fit into that messy old real world, you know, imperfect political entity that we've all always lived in as long as the species has been around. And I think some people are beginning to get that, but still the default mode is we are not governed by the normal rules, laws, and limitations of everybody else. So I hope you're right, but I have some, I'm skeptical.
Mm-hmm. John Perry Barlow is another person that you mentioned. Can you talk a little bit about his influence?
Gosh, it's hard to say. Well, I don't know if your audience knows who he is. He was a co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and he was a former lyricist for the Grateful Dead, and he's very much a, how can I say, highly quoted, very media visible, you know, guy around the net. What can I say? And he's very much been sort of the, I would say the avatar of the drug, sex, rock and roll, revolutionary hero, you know, kind of the rock star ethic, which, you know, very much still pervades high tech, and that a lot of guys who want to be CEOs of startups, it's like they sort of see it as being the equivalent of a rock star. So in a lot of ways, they're more, I think he's more interested in as a cultural icon of the way rock stars both have establishment trappings, you know, money, glamour, whatever, but also get to have rebel outsiders standing at the same time. So I see him as sort of being influential, again, in a style sense, which I don't think is trivial.
Mm-hmm. So he would be an example of what you refer to in the book as ravers?
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh. So someone who's – there's a recent book out, actually, by a conservative culture critic about Bobos.
Oh, I heard about that. Yeah, book, right.
Bohemian bourgeois.
Yeah.
And he thinks that that middle-class folks, educated middle-class folks, have adopted a countercultural stance at the same time having all the advantages of being establishment.
Right.
Which sounds like it might have some advantages, but who are the culturally conservative part of this culture?
Well,
you refer
I mean,
to them
again,
as...
it varies, but, you know, the one person I pick on with great glee in the book is George Gilder, who was the you know, a speechwriter for Reagan and, you know, has, you know, conferences and newsletters and is sort of seen as a big thinker. And, you know, and he's just like, you know, wacko 19th century retrograde in terms of his attitude towards, like, women. And he's incredibly, I find, you know, and he's got this kind of goo-goo-eyed slobbering over great men that is kind of, to me, almost crypto-fascist. I mean, the way he loves great men is just kind of like, ew. It's kind of, so, but, you know, there are definitely people within high tech who are socially conservative and who share his contempt for a certain kind of libertineness and hate Washington. And, you know, and most people in high tech hate Washington, but he hates Washington in the way that people on the wacko far right hate Washington, which is, you know, it's like basically we should you know, there shouldn't be an FCC and there shouldn't be an FTC. I mean, it's this real sort of, you know, not that he's like the militia people, but it's sort of common cause with those kinds of people. So, I mean, again, it's not like anyone has signed up to belong to a particular party or they've joined an organization, but you see the thread running through high tech, and he kind of personifies it.
I'm speaking with Paulina Borsuk about her new book on the cyber-selfish subculture of techno-libertarianism. And she's
let me just correct you. The subtitle, because I like the subtitle, is A Critical Romp to the Terribly Libertarian Culture of High Tech.
And that book can be found at www.cyberself.com. And you can find links there also to Paulina Borsuk's webpage, where she's got dozens and dozens of articles on dozens and dozens of topics. She's written for Newsweek, Mother Jones, San Francisco, Salon, Suck, and Feed. And you mentioned recent, just now, you mentioned that they haven't joined a particular party. And there's been a great deal of mobilization in the high-tech field by different corporations and executives to try to put forward a high-tech agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And Wired was very central in trying to define in an extremely class-ignorant way what the cyber culture's political viewpoints were. And when they did their surveys of their readership and said, oh, it looks like everyone who uses a computer, a modem, and a cell phone is for...
Is libertarian.
Yeah, is libertarian and lowering taxes and everything. It's like, well, duh, you know.
Yeah.
But There's been some recent discussion of Al Gore losing that vote. Al Gore had made a strong appeal for the high-tech cognoscenti, and apparently there was some appeal to Bradley, and then there was some shifting over to McCain. So they're all over the place. Where do you see the politics of
Well, that, you know, one of the things about high-tech is that, you know, again, when I may say the libertarian, they may be registered Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, Green, or, I don't know, natural law, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
for a lot of these people, it doesn't affect their voting patterns in any concrete way, except that they will be very anti-regulation. They will want to raise the limit of H-1B visas. They don't like taxes. They think free market, everything is just wonderful. It's hard to say why there's been any shift away from Gore, except that maybe there's a fear that he's too much in bed with the unions because he's a Democrat, though I don't think the unions would feel that he's too much in bed with them. Mm-hmm. And, of course, high-tech hates unions.
Well, the Clinton administration's crossed swords a couple times with the Electronic Frontiers Foundation and those kind of folks over encryption. And
but, you know, if they think – I question whether a Republican administration would be any better because, you know – my feeling is because of, you know, the radical right, the Christian right, which the Republican Party always has this uneasy allegiance with, they are very uncomfortable with freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
and they're very much in bed with, much, I would say, much more in bed with law enforcement than the Democrats, though again, the Democrats have been pretty in bed with them as well. So it's hard for me to see that the Republicans offer something better than the Democrats, except that maybe they feel that the Republicans would offer a better, you know, more or less a fair economic, like, you know, trade with China, for example, than the Democrats. But that's hard to say because an editor at San Francisco Magazine wanted me to do an article on how, you know, Bush is really winning over Silicon Valley and it's going Republican. And I kept on saying, I don't think so. I mean, the Valley has always been pretty evenly split between Democrat and Republican in terms of who the elected representatives are. It tends to vote kind of socially moderate or even liberal and fiscally conservative. I mean, it doesn't fit into the normal perspective of left and right and Republican and Democrat that the rest of the country does.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you try to put it into that box, it doesn't quite work.
Now, do you think that this is really qualitatively different from previous industrial epochs when new industries, industrial sectors came out? The leaders of those industries were probably always had a libertarian orientation, or at least, you know, the last 200 years.
Yeah.
I think there may be different in terms of the massification of that libertarianism.
I think the massification is different. And also, on one hand, I totally agree with you. And if you look at San Francisco, late 19th century, the gold rush, but even more importantly, the silver rush later on in the decade, there's a lot of the same self-validating rhetoric of, you know, we are wonderful, we are blessed, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. But I think, you know, there's a difference, you know, that, you know, it is the massification, and it's also this hero, you know, Ayn Rand-like hero, solo, I am me, when actually they've been such incredible beneficiaries of government in a million ways. Like, when I get into arguments with libertarians of any kind out here, I say, and where would you rather do your startup, in the former Soviet Union or in Northern California, where we have rule of law and intellectual property is protected and the cops aren't terribly corrupt and the water is sort of clean and the pharmaceuticals are more or less not going to make you sick? And, you know, I mean, I list through all these embedded, invisible hand of government that make this such a great place to make money, and they don't see it. Similarly, in California, we used to have the best public schools in the country until something called Prop 13 came in 1978. And I went to public school for part of that time before Prop 13, and I remember what it was like. And basically, since then, our funding for public education is ranked around Mississippi, famous for its catfish farms. And so if people in high tech complain about how they can't get enough qualified workers, but they don't make the link to Prop 13. And you can say it's an old-fashioned kind of imperialism. You're exporting the cost of education to India and to Israel and to Taiwan, but the linkage doesn't get made.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you start bringing in the brain drain from the rest of the world in order to make up for your own decadent deficits.
Yeah.
Now, you've also signed on to the techno-realism manifesto. What was that whole flap about?
Oh, gosh. Hard to say. Well, I mean, let's try not to be too cynical.
Yeah.
Well, supposed to have been about.
There are Luddites in the world and...
What?
There are Luddites in the world, and then there are the techno-enthusiasts, right?
Right, and what the techno-realists are trying to say, let's take a sane third path. and you know, that, you know, we're neither Luddites nor celebrants, and, you know, and it kind of exists because it's a human artifact. Technology is embedded in all kinds of human and social systems, and we need to look at this in a kind of less polarized way. And that I totally signed on to, but as with anything like this, when you have, you know, 12 very individualistic writers and all kinds of hidden agendas that I wasn't aware of when I signed on to, it kind of ended badly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's interesting because when that whole kerfuffle happened, which was about 2 years ago now, a lot of people saying, oh, this is just so over, and no one buys into that old libertarian view of technology, and what are you talking about, and that's so 1996. But, you know, I noticed that's not the case, because there was, a bulletin board discussion area on Feed's website about the techno-realist thing, and once again, it was swamped by the libertarians. Mm-hmm. In other words, maybe the people in the policy elite, or the 5,000 people on the planet who think about this stuff really hard, aren't buying into certain kinds of libertarian premises anymore. But that doesn't mean this ideology isn't still there really, really, really pervasively. And it's amazing to me how often I can be in some situation, like an example I use in the book, I was flying back from New York to San Francisco about a year or two ago, and I sat next to a guy who'd been in the PC industry for, I don't know, 20 years, and he'd been in a conference in New York, and we were just talking, and he was amazed at how I knew what he thought about everything. He thought I was psychic. I wasn't psychic. I just know what the culture of Silicon Valley is. And he was a deeply fundamentalist Christian, and we had all kinds of interesting discussions about whatever, and it was very clear to me that the libertarianism of high tech had somewhat modulated his belief system, and that if he had lived like in Arkansas, he wouldn't be, let's say, uneasy about being anti-choice, because he believed in his libertarian religion was stronger than his Christian religion.
Mm-hmm.
So to say that it's over because, you know, we don't hear so much about that, you know, Wired, it's just a business magazine now as opposed to a propaganda organ, is not to understand what the nature of culture and religion is. It's rather like saying the 60s ended at the Altamont concert in 1969. Actually, in some ways, you could say the 60s have kept on going, because you got feminism and you got gay rights and you got continual experimentation with drugs and, you know, things that not to mention identity politics, all that stuff that started in the 60s just kept going. So it didn't just end because a certain aspects of the dream were over.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say that people in the Valley are very concerned about the Microsoft breakup, and because it shows the ambivalence that they have between these two sides of their personality.
Again, there's all different kinds of people in the Valley, and I've seen a different reactions. And some people, they really hate Microsoft, they really hate the government, and they don't know what to do, you know, which thing they hate more. But other people who are very extreme say, you know, if the government could do that to Microsoft, they could do it to any of us. And, you know, there's a piece they're missing, which is the government is doing it for us. They're not doing it to Microsoft. And if they're intellectually honest with themselves, it's like they'd realize how much Microsoft has stifled innovation, which is the thing that they should most care about, and has stifled competition, which is the thing they should most care about. But they're very, you know, ambivalent about what the remedy should be, or maybe they hold on to the dream that the market will take care of it, and if the government would just wait, it would all sort itself out. But I don't think there's much evidence to back that up. Or, as I'm fond of saying, okay, monopolies come to an end, but you look at something like the Hanseatic League, which had a nice 200-year run in, you know, medieval Northern Europe. So there's a lot of conflict around the whole Microsoft thing.
Mm-hmm.
Internal conflict.
Now, one of the questions I have about the techno-libertarianism is whether, as the technologies of communications and computers become mm-hmm. more mass use,
mm-hmm.
The original roots of this technology, which were very much caught up in unmarried males and a culture of unmarried males, and unmarried males are by their nature more libertarian in the world, puerile, adolescent, don't tell me what to do kind of attitude towards the world.
And there's no cost for anything.
Right.
I think it's almost that there's just everything, there's no cost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as it becomes more massified, do you think that you'll begin to develop other cyber cultures?
Well, you know, not to get semantic with you, but it depends what you mean by cyber culture. I mean, these days it's used to talk about anyone who's using AOL to send email to a grandchild,
right,
to, you know, someone who's a sysadmin at a hospital. In other words,
right,
there's a lot of different, you know.
We don't talk about telephone cultures.
Right. It depends what you mean by people in high tech. But what I But what I think often happens is that when people who stumble into this culture and are very besotted with it, they do adopt the ideology, rhetoric, language, whatever, of the culture that was already there. So probably the grandmother sending, you know, email to her granddaughter isn't thinking about this stuff, but maybe someone who's, I don't know, I'm just going to make something up, customer support at AOL, you know, which of course is a very middle America kind of company, you know, they may pick up some of this stuff and not really kind of know where they got it, but it's just kind of in the air that they breathe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's certainly a dominance. If you go to the different websites, there's many more, a disproportionate number of libertarian websites.
Totally. There. And if you go to any computer science department, in other words, you know, chances are, I mean, any time you see two or more of people remotely tech-identified get together, I mean, I can't say the number of times I've been having a conversation with some sweet, smart geek that I know who'll go, I'm not a libertarian, meaning like I'm not that like that crazy person over there, but I think the government interferes in people's lives too much, or I'm not a libertarian, but I think the free market is the best way to, you know, sort things out, or, I mean, it's like, you know, women who say, I'm not a feminist, but I believe in equal pay for equal work.
Right, exactly. So. Well, I really want to recommend your work, and your book just came out Friday.
Yeah, it came out Friday. It probably won't be in bookstores for a couple of weeks. What the publication date means, I've been told, is it's the day the book leaves the warehouse.
Why are we talking about bookstores? They can buy it on AOL at Amazon.com, right?
Oh, that's true. But they can buy it on Amazon.com, and they're welcome to do that. But I'm a big believer in supporting, you know, local communities and independent bookstores. So.
Okay, good. I've been talking to Paulina Borsuk. And again, you can find her work at www.cyberselfish.com. I really want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.